Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C, this is Agriculture Today.
At the White House Tuesday,
I'm going to take action that I've been looking forward to doing for 18 months.
And with those words, President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Bill.
Yeah, now law.
A law the president called
one of the most significant laws in our history.
Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack says it's certainly significant for rural residents and farmers. He told reporters in Michigan earlier this week,
the Inflation Reduction Act has enormous resources for conservation, for forestry, for decarbonizing our rural electric cooperatives, all of which will have a profound impact on lowering costs for rural families and also on creating jobs in rural communities and allow farmers the opportunity to improve soil health and soil quality and water quality.
While, he says, boosting productivity
and increasing their bottom line.
This is Gary Crawford, Washington.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
2022 has not been without its challenges, as we all know.
Speaking at the annual convention for the American Coalition of Ethanol, that's Rod Snyder. He's the senior advisor for ag at the Environmental Protection Agency, or EPA.
We're still in the heels of a global pandemic, and Putin's unprovoked war in Ukraine has had a profound impact on energy markets, creating a ripple effect for consumers in the United States and across the world. And so as part of a multi-pronged strategy to address this crisis, just a few weeks after I was out here, President Biden actually went to Iowa and visited an ethanol plant to announce that the federal government would issue a national emergency waiver to allow E15 gasoline to be sold during the summer months throughout the United States. Of course, without this action, E15 couldn't be used in most of the country between June 1st and September 15th. So Administrator Regan, in consultation with Energy Secretary Granholm, has issued a series of 20-day emergency waivers preventing further disruption to the summertime fuel supply. So at the nearly 2,700 gas stations nationwide where E15 is sold, the emergency waiver has made a real difference at the pump and provided lower-cost options for consumers.
Those attending were very interested in what the senior advisor would say about RVOs.
Last year, the administrator made it very clear that getting the renewable fuel standard back on track has been one of his key priorities. Of course, the impacts of the pandemic and prior policy decisions had really left a pretty challenging situation when this administration arrived. I think most of you know that there had been no RVOs established for 2021, so we had some catch-up work to do. That's why in early June, EPA announced several actions that will help provide a path forward for the sustained growth of renewable fuels and reinforce the foundation of the RFS program. First, the rule finalized volume requirements for 3 years, 2022, 2021, and 2020. We also finalized a 250 million gallon supplemental obligation to the volumes proposed for 2022 and stated our intent to add another 250 million gallons next year to address the demand for the annual rule that was remanded by the DC Circuit. Let me be clear, the 2022 RVO is the largest volume ever finalized by the agency, which we believe places the RFS program back on a trajectory of responsible growth after several difficult years. In addition, EPA also took action this spring to deny more than 100 small refinery exemption petitions that were pending before the agency. As you are likely aware, the Clean Air Act sets out a process where small refineries may petition EPA annually for exemption from their RFS obligations. The specific reading of the language of this exemption and EPA's implementation of it has been the subject of a lot of litigation over the last 4 years. In 2021, the Tenth Circuit Court of Appeals held that EPA cannot grant exemptions for small refineries unless they experience disproportionate economic hardship caused by compliance with the RFS program. And so in denying the SREs, we have signaled a significant shift from the prior administration, and we are doing so in a transparent manner through which stakeholders have been able to review our technical and legal analysis. So together, these actions that were announced in June reflect the Biden administration's commitment to reset and strengthen the RFS program and to support domestic low-carbon alternatives to fossil fuel-based transportation, which is what Congress intended when adopting the RFS more than 15 years ago.
Again, Rod Snyder, Senior Advisor for Agriculture at EPA on the renewable volume obligations for the RFS. It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Look, this WASD last week wasn't a big market mover at all.
It might surprise you if you saw how the cotton market reacted, but we're focusing on grains right now. Guy Allen, director of the International Grains Program.
I guess I was anticipating maybe some lower world production numbers, but probably the wheat numbers were the most market moving on the day. World production came in 8 million tons higher than it did in July. It came in at record 779.6 million metric tons, which was actually 400,000 metric tons higher than last year's previous record size crop. A lot of those changes in production were seen by the recovery from the drought situation that we saw in the northern part of the U.S., in the plains, and then up into Canada. Canada's estimate was increased a further 1 million metric tons to 35 million metric tons. That's compared to last year's drought-stressed crop that was only 21.7 million metric tons. They also, not too surprising, increased Australia production. It was up 3 million metric tons to 33 million metric tons. That'll be one of the top 3 years record production in Australia. Concurrently, they increased Australia's exports by a million metric tons up to 25, as we see quite a bit of wheat coming out of Australia, as well as we're really stressing their port capacity down there. We've seen a lot of mobile and temporary shiploading facilities be set up around the country to get those last 2 years of large crops out of the country. And these alternative locations have sort of been really weighing on the exports and sort of causing U.S. exports of wheat to lag a bit behind expectations. India's production, which had been key, it was dropped 3 million metric tons to 103 million metric tons. That's 6.6 below last year. Export projections were dropped to 6.5 from 10. We had been looking at India to sort of replace some of that Black Sea wheat that has been tied up, particularly coming out of the Ukraine and somewhat from Russia being less accessible to the market. The other one to touch base on is the world's largest wheat producer, China. We actually saw USDA increase their production estimates 3 million metric tons to 138, which is a million metric tons higher than last year. They had their wheat exports at 9.5 million metric tons. I sort of expect that maybe to be a bit higher for reasons we'll talk about here in a minute with weather. Usage was up as well. This took wheat ending stocks down to 267.3 million metric tons. That's down slightly from last month's at 267 million metric tons and down from 276 million metric tons from last year, taking stocks to use to just under 34%. And look, we continue to tighten up this wheat balance sheet to the point, again, as I say, we're going to have to price wheat out of that feed ration. And to some extent, given corn, wheat's going to follow corn, I think, because it's actually a tighter situation. It's going to have to stay at a premium to corn, keep quite a bit of wheat out of that feed ration.
Now focusing on corn.
This report for corn, global ending stocks fell nearly 6 million metric tons for this year. A lot of that was on decline in the Ukraine's exports and production there. We continue to watch that Black Sea and the Ukraine corn exports. It was actually raised a bit by 5 million metric tons as we're starting to work through some of those logistical situations, and we're starting to see a bit of grain move out of the Ukraine through those Black Sea ports, which is a good sign given the tightness of the global crop situation.
And soybeans.
Nothing really too surprising. The oilseed situation. August is a critical month for soybean production in the U.S. particularly, with the U.S. and Brazil being the two biggest producers and exporters. So I sort of look to that September report next month when we'll have some actual survey numbers come into that. And I think we're going to see some adjustment in global production numbers around the world.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
So to enhance U.S. cotton's competitiveness, particularly through our ag research side, we're trying to minimize production costs, improve yields in the fiber quality. You know, really throughout the entire company, we're trying to reduce plastic contamination in U.S. cotton. That goes from the farm to the gin all the way to the mill.
Barry Worsham is president and CEO of Cotton Incorporated.
We are supporting the U.S. Cotton Sustainability Program, the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol. We want to enhance cottonseed value, both through research on the oil side as and whole seed side, as well as marketing on the promoting it on the whole seed side, as well as the cottonseed oil side. We got to think about the future, improving our fiber quality down the road to help us compete. We want to expand our EFS cotton management system program. That's something that helps tie mills around the world, including the U.S., to U.S. cotton. We want to support CCI. They are the export promotion arm of the U.S. industry. We want to help, along with CCI, cultivate export markets for U.S. cotton. And there may be an opportunity to move more of the demand mill side of it back to the Western Hemisphere. I'm not sure it'll be necessarily the U.S., but certainly if it's in this hemisphere, the Western Hemisphere, that we have a much better chance of selling U.S. cotton in that environment.
And on the topic of fiber competition,
EFS is a cotton management system that is used around the world. It helps tie a mill to U.S. cotton. So without the amount of travel normally because of restrictions, we're trying to find ways of getting that out in a more efficient way, and maybe even a new marketing approach to EFS. So when I talk about sustainability or traceability and transparency, this is a very simplistic description of cotton's journey through the supply chain. So you've got a grower, ginners. It gets to a merchant, goes to a yarn spinner, then you get it converted into fabric. And I'm going to include dyeing and finishing in one of those two pieces. Then it goes to a brand, retailer, consumer. So if the brand retailer wants to know what is exactly in that product and where did it come from, you have to have information that continues to make its way through all the supply chain from grower all the way up to that point. Well, the brand retailer thinks that, we know the retailers know who the brands are. They kind of have a pretty good idea, or I think they can get a good idea of the fabrics, whether it's wovens or knits. But where we kind of break down is the information from the yarn spinner to the fabric. Whereas the yarn spinner knows like where that cotton is coming from, because the merchant knows exactly where the cotton is coming from, whether it's U.S. cotton or West, specifically Texas cotton or somewhere else. And the yarn spinner, certainly if you go into a yarn mill anywhere in the world, they can tell you exactly where the cotton that they're using comes from. But that information is not transferred to the fabric side of it, because that yarn is blended. And that's where maybe that we could add some value. We are looking internally at, is there some way that we can help that particular piece? Because if we can improve that, and this is not just a U.S. cotton thing, it's a cotton issue itself, that would go a long way to helping the brands and retailers get through this issue. So, again, what we're trying to prevent is that somebody throws up their hands and says, this is too complicated. We can't really trace it back. And therefore, let's use something else that has a shorter supply chain or, fewer, there's only so many polyester manufacturers out there or rayon producers. So, that's what we're trying to avoid, and we're still in the early stages of trying to find out where we can really add value.
It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
Of course, our next major RFS rulemaking will be the SET rule.
Speaking recently at the American Coalition for Ethanol's annual meeting, Ron Snyder, Senior Advisor for Ag at the Environmental Protection Agency, on biofuels after the RFS.
And as you were likely aware, the Clean Air Act only prescribes renewable fuel volume targets through 2022. So for years 2023 and after, the Act contains no volume targets, thus directs the administrator to establish new volumes for those years. This proposed SET rule will be the first EPA regulation to establish target RFS requirement during that post-2022 timeframe. As part of a recent consent agreement with Growth Energy announced just a couple of weeks ago, we have updated the deadline for the SET rule, which includes a proposed issuance no later than November 16th of this year and finalization of June 14th of 2023. Among other things, the Clean Air Act requires that EPA analyze multiple factors to determine these volume requirements, including economic, environmental, and practical considerations, air quality, climate change, wildlife and ecosystems, water quality, energy security, infrastructure costs, job creation, price and supply of ag commodities, and rural economic development. All of those factors are identified within the law that the team has to balance as we're making these decisions. We have to look both backwards and forwards as we consider what volumes may be appropriate. For instance, the statute directs us to consider the implementation of the program so far over the last 15 years, reviewing how the fuels market has operated since the program began in 2006. And looking forward, the statute directs us to consider the future commercial production of renewable fuel. All of these factors must be considered in the context of the broad goals of the RFS program to reduce the amount of fossil fuel used in the transportation sector, that being the fundamental goal of the law. The EPA staff has been meeting with stakeholders, I'm sure many of you in the room, over the past year, and we are taking input from those meetings into account as we are actively developing the proposal. And, of course, we're coordinating with both our colleagues at USDA and the Department of Energy as we move forward. We know the volume targets for 2023 and beyond are of great interest. We look forward to continuing this critical engagement as we move forward with subsequent steps in the rulemaking process between now and November.
At first glance, might not see it, but he does say the recent passage of the Inflation Reduction Act plays in.
We are very pleased to see Congress take action on the Inflation Reduction Act, which would be the most significant piece of climate legislation ever adopted in the United States. Includes an additional $500 million to expand blender pumps and other biofuels infrastructure. Of course, this is in addition to the roughly $700 million that was already announced by USDA as part of the earlier packages. The legislation also extends the $1 per gallon biodiesel tax credit through 2024, and sustainable aviation fuel programs would receive hundreds of millions of additional dollars. The bill includes up to $1.75 per gallon tax credit for SAF through the end of 2024, and that is contingent upon the carbon intensity score of those fuels. Just as significantly, the bill provides $20 billion to USDA to support climate-smart agriculture practices for farmers. By helping farmers reduce emissions and sequester carbon, it lowers the carbon intensity score of biofuels fundamentally by providing a lower carbon feedstock. And again, as Brian mentioned, that's an area that I've been very passionate about and working on for quite some time, not only incentivizing those types of climate smart practices on the farm, but also making sure that we're able to capture the data and the information to reflect that within LCAs.
It's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
Just to run around the world, some of the areas that are concerning me, obviously western U.S. corn belt and soybeans, we've been experiencing continuing dry weather as this La Nina situation continues to persist.
Guy Allen's director of the IGP, the International Grains Program at Kansas State.
Other places in the world, Europe is probably the biggest concern at the moment. Very dry across Europe, major crop producing areas all the way from France across through to the Ukraine, causing quite a bit of a concern, particularly because a lot of that Black Sea business had been shifted to Europe, being the next best point of origin into those critical markets of North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, and the Middle East. Also, China, biggest producer of wheat and second largest producer of corn and a lot of major summer crops. They're experiencing some stressed dry weather crops, and I would expect those numbers to come down from current estimates there as well. We're also seeing spotted dry areas across Southeast Asia as that dry weather extends south. Also, India, another major grain producer, is experiencing some dry weather to the point where the government's really ratcheting back the potential exports on that, and that's lending a bit of support. Moving back to the Western Hemisphere, Argentina has had dry weather, and that's starting to impact the summer crop situation particularly. So I wouldn't be surprised to see those five or six markets around the world, USDA bring those production numbers down, which I think in September will lend some additional support to prices.
Another concern that many have been watching is the freight rate situation.
We've seen quite a bit of volatility in this bulk dry freight market in the last 12 to 18 months particularly. We saw 14-year highs in that market this time last year, and we've seen that market come off quite a bit. It was up in the 5,000s just this last week. It's traded closer to the 1,400 number. And keep in mind, what drives that bulk freight market isn't grain. Grain's less than 20%. It's really coal and iron ore particularly that's driving that. And we're seeing that demand sort of drop off. Ocean freight rates are coming down. And that freight component is an important part of the price for our importing customers. The other thing that a lower freight rate does, when we have a high freight rate, it makes exporters such as the Black Sea, Australia, where they're freight advantaged to those markets, particularly the high-value markets of China and Southeast Asia, more competitive. But as that freight rate comes down, it makes the U.S. grain and exports a lot more competitive into those higher-valued markets.
But it really comes back to how much does it cost to buy from the U.S.?
It's interesting. Today I was interested to hear Brian Biggerman's comments on sort of the macroeconomic issues, particularly relative to U.S. inflation rates and interest rates. And what's driving that value of the U.S. dollar relative to other currencies is our increasing interest rates. Mm-hmm. Foreign exchange rates are really driven by the differential in your interest rate situation. And as the Fed continues to signal that we're going to see higher U.S. interest rates, that makes for a stronger U.S. dollar. And they're doing that to get on top of the inflation situation, which is adding to the price of world commodities across the board. A lot of other countries can't afford to raise their interest rates proportionally. And so their currency becomes less competitive. So I think that strength in the U.S. dollar is something that's going to be around for a good length of time in the near future, multi-years forward. And it's going to be a significant component of the competitiveness of U.S. commodities into the global marketplace.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We have four basic committees. We have the agricultural side, which includes ag research as well as sustainability. We have an R&D committee, which includes the product development implementation as well as fiber competition. We have a supply chain marketing committee and a consumer marketing committee. So there's four basic committees, two of which contain two different divisions.
Barry Worsham, President and CEO, Cotton Incorporated.
So in our Agricultural Environmental Research Division, that's headed up by Dr. Cater Hake, and Ryan Kurtz has been named as the successor beginning in January. And the priorities are the same as they've been. It's pest management, it's seed quality, continuing to improve the sustainability of U.S. cotton through greater soil health and nutrient management, always looking at emerging technologies, automation, machine vision. Genomics obviously has a lot of potential as far as cotton. And, you know, these are, like I said, these priorities don't change that much from year to year in on the margin, like some maybe have a little bit more emphasis in a particular year. But these are things that are pretty widespread. These are things that are going to be important for some time to come. In the one of the areas that has gotten a little additional attention is cottonseed oil, some human health studies. We know that for the cottonseed market to be really healthy, we need a demand for the whole seed as well as the products, the meal and oil. We've been had research sponsored now for several years on the potential for cottonseed oil may be actually a heart healthy oil, which is counter to what perceptions are. I know there's been at least three studies done. We've done two, and they both, or actually three ourselves. When I say we, I mean Sponge Cotton Incorporated sponsored. These studies have shown that there is the cottonseed oil does have some health benefits, reducing cholesterol, your bad cholesterol. It's been also done in mice, which shows the pathway as to why that may be the case. And I'm not a technical enough person to give you the details of that. But this is still in the kind of the early stages, and I think it has some potential. And this is something that we are going to be expanding going forward to continue to have additional research to get that out in the public domain. And hopefully some private money will come in and also look at this and hopefully duplicate these studies to show that, yes, this is a real potential for the cottonseed oil market. In sustainability, this is a division that's only been out there for probably around 5 years or so, headed up by Dr. Jesse Daystar. You know, we work very closely with the National Cotton Council and developing the sustainability goals that some of you may have heard about, but also supporting the U.S. Cotton Trust Protocol, which is the we'll call it the verification sustainability program for U.S. cotton, which is hopefully or is growing in importance. We're trying to take a sustainability leadership and engagement role where Cotton Incorporated is becoming more of a voice. So when people have questions in the industry about sustainability, that we can provide expert and unbiased information. We have a good story to tell, and we're trying to do that. Plastic pollution, key thing, as we talked about before, cotton degrades, polyester doesn't. This is a big issue, and this is a priority for our division, really company-wide. And we're always looking to assess objectively what is the environmental impact of cotton products. We do life cycle assessments for major products for cotton, knit or woven, and I think we're doing one for cottonseed oil. And then also sustainability communications. Having all this information really doesn't do you any good unless you're able to communicate that out to industry. So Jesse and his team work very closely with consumer marketing and the supply chain marketing team to craft information that we can get out to brands, retailers, and consumers as well.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
A tale of two corn-producing regions in USDA's latest look at global production.
European Union and Ukraine, kind of two opposite stories there.
World Agricultural Outlook Board Chair Mark Jakodowski says the EU faces
very severe drought and record high temperatures, really stressing corn. Given the weather conditions that we've seen and looking at the satellite data, suggests that the corn crop is struggling. So we reduced our production estimate by 8 million tons, down to the current forecast of 60 million metric tons, and that would be down about 11 million tons year over year.
While favorable growing conditions are reported in Ukraine.
The satellite imagery suggests corn crop is coming along quite nicely. They've had favorable weather conditions, plenty of rain, relatively cool temperatures. So we raised our production forecast for Ukraine by 5 million metric tons.
Yet year over year, Ukraine corn production is forecasted down by over 12%. I'm Rod Bain reporting in Washington, D.C.